This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello, and welcome to the Saxo Market Call, 21st of April, 2021. Boy, market's really getting spooked late yesterday. You're seeing all the headlines attributing this to the latest COVID wave, but why on earth was this not the case when COVID cases were busily ramping like crazy in the previous couple weeks? I guess the proximate trigger might have been, at least in this case, overnight in Japan, where there's discussion about the need to shut down or do an emergency declaration for Tokyo and Osaka, and an ex-minister saying that Japan should either cancel or delay the Olympics. In any case, Japan was down really badly on top of the pretty ugly declines. Not terrible, but you know, a solid additional sell-off in the U.S. And before I hand it over to you, Peter, just want to point out, I put up the NASDAQ 100 weekly continuous future on slide two. Looks a little bit bearish if we do start turning around here a bit more profoundly in terms of the momentum picture. So a new high that was posted recently, now we're trading back just below that previous high in the high 13,000s. And of course, the momentum reading, because we've only had a short rally relative to the prior one, at a divergently low level. So I guess pretty tenuous here. We're going through the heart of earnings season, maybe as well. I don't know if it was the Netflix earnings overnight that might have added a little bit of extra sour sentiment, because Netflix is down badly after hours. But I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, we'll talk about Netflix later into the podcast or later in the podcast. In terms of what happened yesterday, I think you're right on the whole Japan angle, but then also the as we talked about, India and that new variant that the UK authorities, health authorities, have been talking about. I think they're shutting down traveling now to India. They're very worried about this new variant. And you saw the response pretty clearly. The market discounted travel stocks, as you can see on slide three. Worst performing theme basket, travel basket, was down 3.5%. You could argue that if we are worried about increased, you know, COVID-19 cases and extended lockdown, you would have expected e-commerce to perform better. So a little bit of a contrarian move right there. But travel stocks for sure was really doing bad. And then on the flip side, don't pay too much attention on the MSCI Emerging Market Index and the China Consumer Technology Baskets, because they, on a massive down day where you start the day in a more positive green territory, you will have this divergence because of the time zone differences. So the mega caps are the ones that I think shined yesterday. Again, they have been really doing well. It's by far the best performing part of the market this month. It's up 6%, doing quite well as well year to date. And they are providing a lot of safe haven. And that could be the case as well, you know, over the coming weeks. But I think the key story to track is that we now, you know, we've moved into kicked into gear in terms of earnings, and we've got a lot of different earnings over the past couple of days. And I think there's a red thread. So Procter & Gamble are reporting that they are expecting to hike prices on diapers and related products already in September. Kimberly-Clark doing price hikes in June. Essity, which you asked, John, before we went on the call, is this Swedish pulp manufacturing company. They're doing all sorts of different paper-related consumer products. They are also hinting or pointing to more inflation, hiking prices. You still have the lumber prices accelerating in the U.S., and that caused Home Depot recently to also say that they really experienced these pricing pressures. So, and in slide four, we've put in the New York Fed's own new inflation gauge index, which is it's a very broad inflation basket, which tries to be a little bit more timely and broader than the traditional CPI basket. So this basket here has a lot of online and offline prices, so should reflect more broadly the economy. And as you can see here, we've put in the 6 months change in the year-over-year rate. I think the year-on-year rate in March ended at around 2.1%, but the 6 months change here in that index, year-on-year index, is now the second highest since 1995, and we know it will continue higher given all the talks we're getting from the different companies. So this is absolutely key. And when will the interest rate market react to this and the currency market, John? That's the big question, I think.
Yeah, and as well, I mean, it's so difficult with these gauges of inflation and knowing where the fiscal impulse has been. And it's been so dramatic over the beginning of this year, and the recent one just carried out in March. So we all know there's this crazy a pile of stimulus hitting the markets from last year, even, and also what's been carried out this year. But what happens when we get to the fiscal cliff, so-called, Q3, Q4, unless they're renewing these packages, which we, of course, don't know if they're going to do at this point in time. It is certainly not on the drawing board. So such a critical debate from now and really through the next at least 3 to 6 months, the course of inflation. But at least in terms of yesterday, we had a very classic risk-on, risk-off type of pattern across markets and into FX, because despite these inflationary pressures you mentioned, we had treasuries quite strongly bid. We had the European yields that we were talking about yesterday reversing course quite sharply ahead of tomorrow's ECB meeting. And with this combo, double whammy, if you will, of risk-off in equities and treasuries being bid, safe haven trade there, we saw the yen rising to the top, as it often has in the past. So the dollar was firm, but the yen was even firmer. And some pretty interesting technical developments in yen crosses, as I highlight on slide 5 yesterday. I've brought up a couple times recently the prospects potentially for a double top formation in euro-yen after it cut lower and then reapproached the top. We had a real ugly tease for those that were getting bearish, because it did pop to new highs yesterday, but those were absolutely very viciously erased. So it sets up a bearish hook technically for trading this to the downside for now. And then Aussie yen also kind of teasing recently, like it was going to complete a head and shoulders formation. It didn't do that. It started heading back higher, and then it had a similar bar yesterday with an even more climactic reversal. And if you look at your charts there, you still have what could arguably be a very sort of malformed head and shoulders formation with a neckline around 8250. But if you pull up your trusty Japanese Ichimoku charts, which you can on your Saxo Trader or whatever platform or charting tool you're using, look at the Ichimoku cloud. It's got a lower bound for the next at least couple weeks, if I recall, just below that 8250 level. And a lot of Japanese traders key off of this very interesting technical analysis style. And then just to round out FX, you see your latest trend readings on slide 6. And as we are sort of, our trend, as it should be, our trend evolution is sort of slow to pick up these sudden shifts in markets. So you're not seeing anything dramatic besides a little bit of momentum shifting, but just highlight something like Aussie dollar, somewhat similar to Aussie yen, but we were trying to work higher. That close above 78 was really needed, I think, to help to help the argument for a new bullish revival here, and we did not get that. So we saw a pretty ugly reversal bar there as well. And then you're tempted to read into this a potential for, again, completing a head and shoulders formation, but we're not there yet. So the damage has been done a little bit, but it's really a close below around 76.50 there. And I would argue that would only come if we're going to see further declines in risk sentiment, Aussie very risk sentiment, sensitive to risk sentiment. And we would also likely need to see industrial commodity metals coming under pressure. So that rounds out the view. And then I want a brief note on commodities. Oil is off a little bit, of course, pro-cyclical concerns on COVID, et cetera. But gold, enjoying that yield sensitivity, enjoying those lower yields and treasury strength, and somewhat further cementing this recent rise above that key, I believe it's 1765 area. It needs another leg higher to really sort of reverse the prior sell-off wave, but it's an interesting one to watch as well. Seems to me trading mostly as a proxy for treasuries. But let's get back to you, Peter. I mean, we have a busy earnings calendar this week, and one of the marquee names during the pandemic, Netflix, down big post-close. Take us through that and what else is on your radar.
Yeah. So slide 7, we were down to around the 500 level in the extended trading. I've marked that with the red horizontal line right there. So we are in back to the congestion area of Netflix share price over the past year. And I would say, if you look at the share price performance, if we not talk about the earnings for a while, but just look at how the market is pricing in the future and the information on Netflix, it's a very unusual period for Netflix. It's not like we haven't been through sideways markets before. We saw it in 18 and 19, but the sheer volatility on unchanged level here, back and forth, I think is quite unusual. And talking about the earnings, so the Q1 Net change in subscribers were 4 million for the quarter versus 6.3 million expected. Revenue was in line with expectation and earnings were better than expected. But it was the outlook. So the Q2, you can see it here from the Bloomberg terminal. I've put it in as a small insert from slide 7. You can see with marked in light green there, the net change expected for Q2 is only 1 million versus 4.4 million expected by the market. And if you take the combined subscriber base of Netflix and you do, you annualize the 1 million change, I mean, basically growth have come to a complete stop for Netflix. And they were talking endlessly on the earnings call about, it was COVID-19 that was the fault of this this hiccup in the subscriber growth, which interestingly enough, COVID-19 was a plus and a tailwind for them just 6 months ago, and now it's suddenly a headwind. And what have really actually changed? They say it's not competition per se in video streaming or linear TV, as they say, that is the problem. They are hinting a little bit in the end of the earnings call that gaming is pulling eyes away inside the entertainment segment, away from probably video streaming and into e-gaming streaming, but also generally gaming as an activity, where you would say Netflix is a more passive type of entertainment. Gaming is much more addictive and an active participation entertainment activity. So
what is watching gaming then?
Well, I would say whether you watch your favorite TV series on Netflix or whether you watch someone play, I don't know, Counter-Strike, I guess it's the same, right? Wouldn't you agree?
I guess I was just, I'm getting too old for this for this space, clearly. But an interesting, of course, differentiation, though, still, because Netflix doesn't offer any kind of watching gaming content.
No, exactly. But that, I think, is a key point here. I think they're hinting a little bit that they are acknowledging gaming as an important part of entertainment. So you could expect two things for Netflix. If they're smart, I've said this before. I mean, you have to sometimes broaden your perspective of what you are as a company. If you had been a railroad company and defining yourself as transportation, you would have naturally bought yourself into airliners and other types of transportation, car manufacturing. At the same time, Netflix, if they don't see themselves a video streaming for TV, traditional TV, but as an entertainment house, then they probably should do, video gaming streaming, and probably also potentially moving into actually, produce and sell video games. It would be a natural thing to do. And they have the brand and the global distribution. So that might be an interesting angle for Netflix. But for now, I'm negative on the company and the stock price.
All right, and it was an interesting point there to see if they try to look at some of the rivals or some of the would-be rivals in that space. Also, we have a huge semiconductor name up today. This ASML, there's been so much focus on the semiconductor shortage. Is there any sense of when this gets ironed out, or is ASML any kind of a key component of that? Or it's more at the start of the whole food chain, I guess, in semiconductors, isn't it?
Yeah, you and I, we discussed previously, John, I think you sent it to me, that ASML, that was in Bloomberg, wrote this article about the company. They have almost a 70% market share in semiconductor manufacturing equipment. So they produce these very highly advanced lithography machines that can do high precision manufacturing for semiconductors, computer chips in general. So they are very early on in the whole global supply chain of semiconductors. And they are out today with their Q1 earnings, which were strong, of course. But then they also putting out an outlook with a blistering 30% growth rate on revenue for 2021 in the current fiscal year versus the current consensus from the day before at 16% growth. So twice as much. They're basically riding this huge demand, and Intel's and TSMC and Foxconn plan to, I think in Taiwan, the TSMC is building the largest semiconductor manufacturing plant ever in history. Intel is also preparing work in Texas, and you have Foxconn also preparing a new manufacturing plant in the US to meet demand. And all of that, fuels into equipment demand, which, which creates growth for ASML. They are the biggest player. There are no signs that this demand for computer chips is slowing down whatsoever, and it probably will carry into 2022.
I guess that obviously, from what you just said, there must be some sort of geopolitical angle there as well. This whole attempt, likely in the coming years, by the US to make sure that they have a diverse source geographically for high-level chips, so they're not all concentrated in Taiwan. there was that recent Japanese-U.S. statement on Taiwan, the first statement on Taiwan since 1969. China not too happy about that. So we need to keep geopolitics high on the radar. That issue, as well as Navalny in Russia and you know, Russian troops massed basically at the Ukrainian border. I've seen estimates of 100,000 or something like that. So let's keep an eye on those things. Elsewhere in politics, not so much geopolitics, but just really fascinating. We've been tracking a little bit of this on the podcast, the German political situation with the rise of the Greens. And this is taking on new urgency as we've seen the Greens nominating their candidate, Annalena Baerbock, and the CDU with their uninspiring candidate, Armin Laschet, if that's how to say his name. And the latest poll, one from Bloomberg is citing, I've got the headline on slide 9, saying that the Greens are actually in the lead over the CDU-CSU bloc at 28% to 21% for the CDU-CSU bloc. And that's an incredible result. I'll have to look for some confirmation of that in coming weeks. But if you look at where the polls have been going, of course, directionally, they've been going away against the CDU-CSU's favor. That's the black line on the chart lifted from Wikipedia. But the Greens were still far below, you know, several percent below the black line in recent polling. So that bears watching. We cannot emphasize how much this would mean for Europe. The biggest development, at least since the sovereign debt crisis, and possibly well before, a pro-Europe party, very much in favor of tighter integration across the European Union. Very, of course, focused on climate issues. That timing-wise, combined with a Macron that'll still be sitting for some time longer in France, and especially Draghi in Italy, you could see something dramatic shaping up in the EU political sphere after this late September German election. So keep that in your sights. Before I get to the macro calendar, Peter, was there anything you wanted to bring up on equities?
No, and not except that we highlighted it earlier this week that the Next Era Energy, one of the biggest utility companies in the U.S., an important, I guess, beacon for the renewable energy space, is this old utility company. I don't actually remember what it was called before Next Era, but they pivoted their business to become fully renewable energy company over the coming decade, and they divesting their the different type of businesses that are not really in the renewable space over time. So I've highlighted that in red. They will report today in the U.S. session, because it's important for the green transformation trade, and specifically with this sub-segment of being clean energy production.
All right, well, watch for that. And as well, the other point I should have made on the previous slide with the or comment on the German position is the complete diametric opposition to the previous focus on fiscal austerity and the so-called debt brake. And that would be the real game changer for Europe, of course, where the whole fiscal stimulus side has been very difficult, and it was only sort of opened up by the outbreak of the pandemic. Let's go to the macro calendar for today. A couple of interesting points here. The Bank of Canada is meeting today. I'm not terribly exercised about that. I think it was more interesting, the signals from the Canadian budget we talked about on yesterday's program. Canadian March CPI is out. A couple of bond auctions worth watching. So late this morning, we have Germany and the 10-year. Interesting to watch what happens with EU yields after the very sharp back and forth to the downside yesterday, but to the previous day to the upside. And then the US Treasury auctioning 20-year notes later in the day. What's the demand like, as we've seen a pretty solid yield decline at the longer end of the US yield curve? And then I want to highlight one more story I think we really need to track for the longer term here. And also for your space, Peter, given that these infotech giants and monopolies in the U.S. Are such a significant portion of corporate profits and market cap, we have the hearing of this Lina Khan. Apparently, they're calling her a tech antitrust icon. And the article I'm linking to, I also sent that out on my Twitter account and on the Saxo Market Call Twitter feed, who has very interesting ideas on how to break up companies and her approach to antitrust. And she is she has been nominated by the Biden administration to fill one of the commissioner spots for the Federal Trade Commission, which would be implemental in sort of any approach from the official side of bringing antitrust moves against the likes of Amazon, where there were some specific comments in that article about how to break up Amazon's operations, et cetera. So I think it's really key to watch this and in the longer term arc of things. Yeah, Peter.
Yeah, if I can add, so if I remember correctly, what is what's important to understand about Lina Khan is that she is trying to pull the antitrust theory and framework or methodology back to its roots of back in the when it started with the Standard Oil days. So what happened was that the antitrust regulation in the US focused on market power and market power abuse in the early days, and that was what led to the the breakup of Standard Oil 100 years ago. And then fast forward, when we came into the 70s and the 80s, you had this renaissance inside the academia with, you know, free market principles. You had Friedman, proponent of this. And out of that grew an understanding that, you know, we shouldn't do antitrust regulation in the US as long as, you know, it didn't matter whether a company had a huge market power, as long as they passed on economics of scale and benefits to the consumer by lowering prices. So it became, you know, a consumer welfare issue. And she wants to pull the antitrust regulation back to its roots on market power. And just quickly, so her idea about Amazon is that, yes, it might be that Amazon is reducing prices, for the consumer, but they're causing pain further down in the supply chain because of their market power. They are squeezing all their suppliers, meaning that they don't have any excess profit, so they cannot raise wages for their employees. So they have a huge part of the supply chain with workers struggling to get higher pay because their companies are being pressured by Amazon. So that's her thinking. That's the different approach, and I think it's hugely important over the coming decades.
Yeah, that's a great exposition of what's going on there. And yeah, the whole consumer harm issue is not really the point when you're talking about the whole ecosystem, portions of the whole ecosystem being destroyed, small businesses and their employees and otherwise. So just really key to watch these kinds of things as we work through this new era of, addressing these kinds of antitrust monopolies, et cetera. All right, that's a wrap for today. We thank you for joining. And of course, we'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.